Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you all for coming out this evening in the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. And if anyone gets out of hand, I do have the gavel up here, so I'm going to use it. For me, it's great to come to the Computer History Museum. I love coming to this place. I've been here a bunch of times. And every time I come here, I beeline right over to that picture out here of Doug Engelbart. He's also downstairs. He's the guy that invented the mouse. And what a lot of people don't remember is he also invented hypertext and online operating systems and all sorts of things. And did it back in the 50s and 60s. Of course, he did it at a time when people thought he was hallucinating these ideas rather than thinking them out. But what he taught me, and I should say he really did teach me because he's my next-door neighbor in Atherton, what he taught me is that all you have to do is think of something that silicon can be involved with, and over time it scales. It just mushrooms into these gigantic businesses that were never before possible. And it's been done again and again, PCs, cell phones, iPods, digital cameras. I mean, we all know these markets that exist today, and searches and wikis and Wi-Fi and blogs and all sorts of stuff for productivity and of late for entertainment or leisure. But perhaps today, September 2006, it's time for this same silicon to invade another business. This business is a $1.8 trillion, 15 or 16% of GDP business where costs go up double digits every year, as opposed to what happens here in Silicon Valley where we lower the cost of our components by 30% a year. And that is going to create this huge and wonderful battle for guys like me who analyze and write books about this kind of stuff. We have this wonderful panel here tonight, and the topic is digital health. What does digital health mean? I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like the six blind guys and the elephant, right? They're all feeling different spots, and one guy thinks it's a wall and a rope and a spear, and you know, maybe that's what will happen tonight. It will have a bunch of different opinions. But I think this is a both timely and wonderful topic to talk about because, for once, technology and digital technology can be transforming a business that touches each of us individual and touches our lives. So I've asked each of the panelists to introduce themselves, give them a little background, and maybe just a quick comment about what digital health is. Then we'll go around again with a series of questions, but send those questions up, and the best one gets this. No, that's not how it goes. But the best questions will be asked to this esteemed panel, and hopefully we'll have a lively discussion. Thanks for coming.
Start. My name is Christine Page. I'm with Kaiser Permanente, and I have two responsibilities. One is marketing, and the others are internet group. The marketing part is sort of the normal marketing stuff, including advertising and the Thrive campaign that some of you might know about. You see it everywhere, right? We're everywhere right now. But the other part, which is really the reason that I think I got invited, is the internet part. And for the part that I do, I'm not an IT person. I work on making sure that the features and functions that represent this very substantial investment we're making in the technology kind of infrastructure behind medical care gets pushed out to our members in a way that's effective and usable and really provokes a high degree of engagement. So that's where I come into the picture. I think Andy asked us to say a word or two about what we think digital health is. We have a lot of different ways of thinking about it. We think about connecting patients to doctors. We think about empowering patients with online tools so that they can do a great deal actually to manage their own health. At a more global level, we think about bringing together the information that represents everything that's going on with that individual patient and connecting that to everything you can know about what has happened with patients with similar conditions and connecting those things effectively so that you get the best possible outcome for that person at that time with that condition. So we have a pretty big vision for what that should be.
Great.
So I'll stop
Thanks.
There.
We're going to go to Tara.
I'm Tara Griffin from Palm Incorporated. Palm has been around the mobility business for 10 years. Many of you probably have heard about us. And while we've changed our name a few times, We've always had a singular focus, and that is that the future of personal computing was going to be mobile computing. And what better area for mobile workers than healthcare? And over the years, Palm has made devices, a portfolio of products that are powerfully simple devices, powerfully simple to use. The current Trio family of products, for example, has great voice and data solutions. We also work with a number of application providers that offer solutions in the healthcare industry. So whether we're working with large hospital networks or small rural clinics, individual physicians or nurses or in clinical trials, the Trio family of products or our handheld products have been instrumental in driving healthcare. And I think all of us are very interested this evening in healthcare in particular, in improving patient care, certainly, and reducing cost and streamlining efficiencies. And we believe that our portfolio of products is going to be instrumental in the future in driving some of these issues.
Hi, I'm Jason Bobe, and I'm here from a company called DNA Direct, who does genetic testing and interpretation services. I'm actually sitting in for the CEO and founder who her horse stepped on her foot yesterday, and so she's living a healthcare experience this afternoon trying to figure out if it's actually broken or not. And so the reason that I'm here is because I want to surf my genome. And I'm working for a company who wants to figure out ways to help patients make meaning out of their genome sequence in ways that a patient can understand and use the web in very useful ways for making this happen, using the power of multimedia and patient-focused health content. So digital health to me is always patient-focused in the ways that I can actually take my health information and people can provide tools to help me live a healthier, happier life. And so I think that really digital medicine and digital health is ultimately about making these tools for patients, and health ultimately happens in the home, and the web is going to allow people to actually be healthier. So that's it.
Great. Thanks. Peter?
Good evening. My name is Peter Neupert. I work now for Microsoft. I returned there about a year ago to start their health solutions team. Digital health means to me, and why I'm back at Microsoft, is how can we transform the delivery of what we think of today as healthcare over the next 20 years? I couldn't think of a better place to be than at Microsoft when trying to tackle a problem as big, as challenging, as universal, and perhaps as aspirational as transforming medicine, and trying to think of how we could best accomplish that. So I think digital health is the future of medicine.
Christine, can you just go back? You know, I'm still confused. I mean, we all have computers at home. We got laptops. Our kids have computers. They play games. You know, enterprises are wired up. They got gigabit connections. Why hasn't this happened yet in the healthcare business? I mean, you know, is it that doctors need to scribble illegible prescriptions? I mean, what is it about digital technology that it's sort of always coming?
It's always coming. Well, you know, I was thinking about what I would want to highlight on this. I was thinking to myself, healthcare is one of the most information-rich areas of human endeavor, and it's still a cottage industry. And in many dimensions, technology is part of it, but it's still paper record bound, right? That's the lack of technology. It's still the best way to predict what kind of procedure your physician's going to use is know what year he or she graduated from medical school. And that's going to tell you a lot,
right?
Because you learn what you learned with your cohort and you continue to practice that. It's not true of everyone, but it's true of a lot of people. If you think about what comes out in terms of new medical knowledge, every year there are thousands upon thousands of articles, way beyond what an individually practicing physician can get organized around. So that's sort of the backdrop, and it's been an area that's slow to change. I think one of the barriers to that change is the fragmentation of healthcare as an industry. Because in any of these investments, we're making a very substantial investment. And we can do that because the logic of how we operate as an integrated system means that we can make the investment and hope to reap the benefit in some fashion. Most of healthcare is very, very fragmented organizationally, so an investment made over here might have a benefit reaped by someone over there, and they're not in the same, they're not connected economically,
right,
not in a direct way. So I think that's been a huge barrier.
Okay.
And it's costly. It's a big investment.
But Peter, you know, Microsoft has made a living by taking generic tools and offering them to a wide, you know, 100 million unit a group and have them use them for their productivity. For healthcare, does it need to be more specific? I mean, are there these general tools that this fragmented industry can grab hold of and use?
I think you have to look at it in a couple of different dimensions. In some dimensions, healthcare adopts advanced technology very readily, and they use a ton of software and other devices to accomplish that. If you look at diagnostic imaging, for an example, advancements happen very quickly. One of the reasons it happens is they can get reimbursed for it. They don't get reimbursed for using information more effectively. As David Lawrence, who was the former CEO of Kaiser, likes to talk about, I think was very insightful, the United States probably spends on the order of $50 billion a year creating new diagnostic capability, whether it be in drugs or whether it be in certain class of devices, and probably spends less than $200 million a year in investing on better ways to deliver healthcare. The rest of the industries have it all inverted. Most R&D dollars are spent on the D part of it, not on the R part of it. Healthcare is just the reverse because that's where the reimbursements are. I don't think it's as complicated as most people in the industry think it is. Information is very heterogeneous in health, from images to very simple data types. And it's that heterogeneity that makes it a complicated information architecture. I think today's computer systems and with the driving down of storage costs, we'll be able to address this problem pretty effectively.
Do you have a thought, Tara? Because last time I was in an emergency room with one of my sons getting stitches, you know, the doctor spent more time looking at his palm and clicking on things than looking at my kid. I'm not sure that's a good thing or a bad thing.
That was a good thing.
Okay. Any thoughts on that of sort of, you know, why this hasn't been adopted? Is it expensive? Is it hard to use? Is it...
I think in some cases, if you have physicians who are older, they have not necessarily been exposed to the technology area. I think as you see people getting out of medical school today, technology is a big part of the way they approach their business. I think that is one of the issues. But if you look at the costs, for example, in driving down the costs, I also see people wearing pagers and carrying telephones as well as a PDA. And so I think the win for the physician and the cost savings would be to trade in that bandolero of devices and carry one device that you can get your instant message, you can get your phone call, you can collaborate with looking at a chest x-ray with someone across the country. I think the big win is the ability to integrate more people into the care of the patient through collaboration.
So one of the issues, I think, is information both delivered to a lot of different devices, as Tara just said, but Peter, you just said, you know, there's a lot of information that's scattered around there in healthcare. Jason, you've got yet another set
right.
of information for both doctors and patients to play with. And, you know, can you just explain in a little more detail on
sure.
what you guys do and how that fits in the grand scheme?
Yeah, so the genome is a giant data set. 3 billion base pairs and 30,000 genes, and currently we're in the process of we look at them on a very limited basis, one at a time, or you know potentially you know multiple markers, but we're only looking at very little pieces of the genome currently, and that's about to change. I mean, we're in the Computer History Museum where it was a lot driven by Moore's Law and a lot of technology getting cheaper, and the same thing's happening in the diagnostic area. But the data itself with the you know genome sequencing getting a lot cheaper and the price of a genome right now, if you were to have it sequenced, might be $18 million, but it's dropping an order of magnitude, and pretty soon for the price of a home PC, you too can get your genome sequenced, but that's just data. And in order to make that useful, you need to have you know, professional experts, you know, gen ed experts and health content writers, and being able to build a personalization platform. You know, the web's perfect for this, where you can, as in Andy's book, you know, codify expertise using web applications and technologies that ultimately it's going to be about, I think, mass personalization of information and codifying expertise. And these systems are, you know, currently being built, but we're still in the early days. And so the technology itself, from my industry, is very quickly become a commodity. And once again, then content is king. And being able to actually make, you know, useful information that patients can understand and doctors can understand is really where the value lies.
Peter, can you just go into a little bit on a business model as you see it? I mean, from my understanding, you know, hospitals or clinics or even doctor's offices, you know, certainly the hospitals years ago were pitched by IBM, oh, you know, we'll just bring in this big mainframe, drop it in here, your problems are solved. And so they tried that for a bunch of years and then took a pickaxe to it. And then, you know, Son went in and go, no, here's what you need, this four-way processor and Unix and databases with Oracle. And, you know, yeah, that maybe that works, maybe that doesn't. But is this something that needs to be done now that we have not infinite bandwidth, but a lot more bandwidth? Does this need something to be done outside of the hospital rather than in the IT department of the hospital? And then Christine, you know, hopefully he says the wrong answer and you argue with him. But do you see what I'm saying? Is there a change in business model that needs to take place from a pure enterprise-like thing where they buy hardware and put software on it to something that can be done outside their organizations?
Yeah, I think it's the wrong question.
Okay.
We'll argue with you. I don't need to do it.
Well, I think the enterprise model works fine for enterprises.
Right.
And then you have to say, what are the right solutions? And I think Christine's organization has a lot of experience on both ends of that. What was the wrong approach and what is a good approach now? So I'll let her speak to that. But the question is, what is the it? And the it is, how do we get community-based information to happen? What is the best, and why would we care about that? Well, let me ask a question. How many people have seen more than one doctor in the last year? That's because care is delivered across a continuum of doctors because of the way our specialties work today. But because of that, nobody has a comprehensive view of your information. The doctor has their view, but not your view. And so one of the business model challenges is most consumers expect the delivery of healthcare to be free. And because of that, you don't have a price mechanism, you don't have a way to incorporate new features, you don't have the feedback loops that we have in other economic parts of our system. I believe that the thing that has to happen is consumers have to say, I'm tired of it, and that I demand to have my information and access to my information in a cost-effective, organized way so that I can be in charge of my health and not be reliant on somebody else to have my best interests.
Is that possible, Christine? The way that HIPAA rules and privacy and all sorts of things, I mean, you know, how can that be implemented?
Well, that's very challenging. You know, it's challenging, especially in the absence of any kind of real standard for people to participate in together. So, you know, any of us making these big investments are thinking to ourselves, well, when we get to interoperability, right, we hope we're going to be in the right place. We hope we're going to have the right tools to help connect to that. And so we're kind of in that pre-period. I mean, I think of it compared to other areas of technology where you're, you know, you're hoping you didn't buy the Betamax.
Is this where I get to argue?
Yes,
yeah, go ahead.
Please.
I got to be on the President's Information Technology Advisory Council, and I was co-chair of the Health Subcommittee. My observation is health has more people talking about standards with fewer standards than any other industry in the history of mankind. And the world doesn't have to wait for a standard. What is needed is somebody that says, I just want to get started. There's plenty of standards to get started to sharing one's health information. Well, the problem in your industry or in our industry is that the vendors don't want to instantiate the standards that exist, and they don't want to be held accountable for being interoperable. It's not that it's hard. They just don't want to do it. And so if there's somebody like consumers demanding that they do it, they will do it because that's the only way they'll sell anything.
T- Tara, can you go into doctors' groups or hospitals or and say, here's the business case, you know, I can lower your costs by X? I mean, as Peter pointed out, you know, it's a reimbursement game, right? Hey, we got this great CT scanner. Maybe we can get a reimbursement for it. Maybe we can't. But anything that's on the IT side is a cost. Now, can you go in and say, no, this is a productivity game. We're going to save you costs with this device and this software connected to these machines. Is it...
I think that is possible department by department, but I think to go in and deploy throughout an entire organization is not so easy, just based on the fact that you do need to fit into infrastructure.
Right.
And for example, when we first came out with Palm devices and the Trio, it was only on the Palm OS, and we saw pretty quickly that hospital infrastructure is very much Microsoft-based. And I'm not just saying that because I'm sitting next to Peter. But that the fact that we have Windows Mobile devices now has really helped us fit into hospital infrastructure instead of, you know, standing out. So I think when you're going department by department and line of business, essentially, you can talk about here's the solution, here's the return on investment. And because it's a smaller group and more than likely a solution that is applicable to that group only, it is an easy win. But I think to deploy broadly throughout an organization is much more difficult.
Jason, I've been meaning to ask you this question since we started. Mm-hmm. The healthcare is driven by, and the $1.8 trillion is based on people getting sick. And it's a fee-for-service business. You get sick, they patch you up for a fee.
Right.
And very little is said about early detection. Now, that's what I happen to have written a book about, which is why I'm asking you this wonderfully loaded question, is, you know, how do you see that rolling out? Because, you know, personal genomics and what you guys are doing is more, I think, on that early detection, let's keep you healthy in the first place mode. How do you see that fitting in a business where there are doctors and hospitals and the like that get paid when you get sick?
Right. Well, I think I'm going to tie this back to the last question, too. I think there's a couple ways to answer that. One is that increasingly patients are going to be start to understand the value of their personal health information, whether or not that's just, whether or not this drug worked for me or what my genome sequence is or what my family medical history is. And they're going to see this value, and there's going to be actually business models for patients potentially to help finance their own healthcare and to reduce their cost of healthcare and to discover, you know, new therapeutics and information for the rest of their family moving forward if they give their health information to some source. Now, let me tie this into something a little bit more tangible, which is Amazon.com. And the more you use it and the more you buy books from it, you know, they have an expert system behind it, which will next time recommend a book. And so there's going to be a lot of interesting things happening where patients can do an in run around, I think, a lot of the healthcare standards making and go out and start filling their information in other ways, knowing that maybe not immediately there'll be gratification, but in some cases there will be. But on a long-term basis, they could even, help the discovery of therapeutics down the road or early detection of certain conditions and such. But you need to, with preventive medicine, there's another issue. So with Amazon.com, you have to use it a lot in order to get recommendations of books that are accurate. With preventive medicine, you are looking, you don't know that you need healthcare. You go to healthcare, you know, you go to a doctor when you get sick, but with preventive medicine, you need people to tell you, based on some sort of factors with personal family medical history, that you should be more aggressive with screening and such. And so, maybe there's enough value in there just with knowing that by sharing their information that they can actually be getting information back that can help them manage healthcare better. But even more than that, I think there's going to be a lot of, once you can tie genome sequence data and more robust data, that they're actually going to start participating. We're all walking clinical trials, and it's what Kevin Kelly calls the triple blind experiment. And that over our lifetimes, if we contribute personal health information to this, that we actually may be helping to create therapeutics and information, which may ultimately 10 years later when we do get cancer, we'll have all this information that we've collected that can help us do cool things. So I don't know if...
Okay, no, no, that's a good answer. Yeah. We'll come back maybe to the business model of that later.
Yeah.
There is a business model today.
I mean, such as?
People spend money to feel better.
Right. Well, right.
There's a $30 billion nutraceutical business in the United States.
Right.
There's a $10 billion massage therapy business. People spend their own money if there's a known benefit. Even if there isn't a known benefit, if there's a hope for benefit.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yes.
And so the question is they have to enable themselves, and we need to encourage them to put it into context where what do they get out of it? That's the sort of consumer exchange. The benefit you get out of sharing with Amazon is you get some result. The result is a better experience, whether it's your information or your dollars when you get the book. We and many other people are doing that, will do that in the preventive space.
So does technology eventually break that logjam between that sort of payer out there somewhere, that faceless insurance company that pays or group that pays, and the consumer who says, I'll pay out of pocket if you could prove the benefit. LASIK surgery is a classic example.
Cosmetic surgery is another great example.
But so what breaks that logjam? I mean, we're stuck with it. It happens again and again, yet, when it comes to healthcare, it's still, it's your corporate plan or your insurance.
Well, I was going to interject here
because
I think the payers, at least probably the payer that most people in this room have, which is your employer, is getting very activated around underwriting early detection of prevention and using, health risk appraisal tools and the host of things that will come after those, right?
Sure.
Those are relatively primitive, but they're a start, where you self-identify and then you get stratified according to your disease state, and then things get sent to you rather than waiting for you to present with some kind of illness. And I think because that's the business model, is they're paying the bill right now and they understand better to find you early than wait till it gets late. They're getting very active both in deploying these tools and even in sending people to use the tools and then follow the regimes that are recommended by them. So I actually think there's employers who are still underwriting health insurance are very good sponsors for the introduction for some of these tools where they can see the direct benefits coming pretty fast.
And I think the model we'll see is very much like what happened with 401ks.
Right.
20 years ago, 401ks are only within institutions and only a limited number of them.
Right.
Today, they're much broader, much richer, much more available for individuals. And I think you'll see the same sort of thing happen from these corporate wellness programs, which will pay the bills to get it started, and then it will become a mass phenomenon available at a consumer and a retail environment.
So if we go to this digital health, which is still a little foggy what that means, is there technology that we're missing today that still needs to be invented or needs to be cheaper? Is it that handheld device that plays color videos or is it more bandwidth to homes? I mean, what is it that is we're missing that still needs to be invented to push this digital health thing closer to existence? Anyone?
It's the iPod for health. No, what it is, the fundamental problem, at least from my perspective, being a computer geek, is the data doesn't flow today. It's very expensive and very hard for a consumer to get access to the data. The data isn't the end in itself. It's the means to a richer consumer experience. But I don't have it today. Who has their health data? Who can go get their chart? You do, and your 4 million members do. But what about the other 300 million of us?
Yeah.
And without that, there's no market for services. Because in the health risk appraisal, everybody fills out a health risk appraisal. That data doesn't go anywhere else. It's not in your EMR. It's not in your chart. You can't share it with anybody. It's just stuck in this little silo. And so no consumer application, no application but that wrote the HRA itself, can do anything with it. And you get tired of filling out the clipboard. How many people like to go to the clipboard and write down the same damn information?
Yeah.
My wife refuses today. She'll go in, she'll fill out the clipboard, and the nurse will ask her the same information. Did you read it on the piece of paper? The doctor will ask the same information. Did you read it on the piece of paper? She won't put up with it anymore.
That's and for the receipt for the $10 copay.
No, so that's just for this is the family history piece that you fill out
Yes.
every time you go to the doctor. It's ludicrous.
I think that what the one of the missing ingredients is, as well, is that individuals need to take a more proactive role in their healthcare and demand, track their information like medical conditions and lab results and drug allergies. And I think it's beginning, but I think that's a missing component as well, that they're pushing on their end too. I think it will happen much more quickly.
I think it's happening in limited circumstances, but I can certainly think of many barriers of why it is not more widespread. And I think, on Peter's point, that absolutely information, the flow of information is important. And all the way down on a fundamental medical research and scientific research basis, information doesn't flow. So there's as a physician, you have very limited access to journal articles unless you're affiliated with a large university who can actually afford to pay for medical journal subscriptions, for example. And there's tons of really interesting medical discovery things that could be doing by crawling all of this medical research that's all in published literature and making new connections and then verifying them in the lab if those journal articles are actually digital and not behind firewalls. So, and the same thing is going on even once we get medical records electronic, if it follows the siloed medical journal approach, the real power isn't just having my information electronic. It's having all of this roomful of information electronic and then crawling it and looking for associations, about when somebody with, had cancer and what therapy that they took and did it work and aggregating all that data together and making new forms of medical discovery. But at a very fundamental level, just with journal articles in the medical and scientific industries, we haven't figured this out. And so that's not a model to follow in electronic medical records either, I don't think.
So if we focus on getting consumers their medical information, getting that data to flow, here's a great question from the audience, which is timely given the headlines of a company up on Page Mill Road. How are healthcare providers going to protect patient information from insurance carriers who can use the information to cherry-pick healthy patients and deny coverage to others? In other words, how do you get the information out there to consumers yet still protect consumers from businesses who, may not want to insure someone who's either genetically and or pre-existing condition to insure? Any thoughts?
Well, I feel we operate in an incredibly well or highly regulated,
right.
Depending on your interpretation, highly regulated environment in which the protection of patient data is, the reinforcements around that get stronger all the time. The amount of training everyone in our company has to take gets stronger every year. And the online protections around that are incredible. And I think, so you have some built-in, right, kind of regulatorily driven things. You also have to have, I think, a certain amount of determination on the part of the people who are managing that data, as we do with our patients, that when you employers are entitled to a certain amount of information because they're paying the bills,
right.
But there's this very important balancing act so that at the same time the individual employee confidentiality is protected. So how you share what you share, how you manage the numbers so you don't get down into cells that are too small where you can identify a condition to a person. Those are some of the really important fine points, yeah, in how we move this stuff forward, because I think without that you're going to lose the confidence of the people who you're most trying to serve, mm-hmm, at the patient level. Yeah. And once you do that, you're not going to have the participation in this great infrastructure we're trying to create.
So Peter, you were saying that, the Kaiser customers can get their online information, but hardly anyone else can. Do we have to force that? Does it require some regulation? Because the way the payer system is set up, it's an added cost. Do they do that? So is this an act of Congress that says thou shalt?
So I think there's two or three parts to that question.
Yeah.
The first part is, unfortunately, at least in my point of view, Congress is getting in the act. There's a bill passed last week. There's three more bills that are up for discussion in the coming weeks about mandating some sets of things. There's the HRAA Act, and they are doing it for federal employees, but that may set a standard or a set,
right,
of direction. I don't think that is a requirement to get the data to flow. I think people need to start. There needs to be some good end-user applications that motivate people, again, because I don't care about my data. It's what I can do with it. Christine has an environment that makes it that they are getting benefit. Why are they doing it? They're doing it like the financial industry did it. Well, it's a lot cheaper to talk to somebody in email than it is to have them walk into my clinic, and I'd much rather have that.
And they like it.
And they like it. Well, yeah, more importantly, they like it. And so I think starting to do that, that the forward providers, the early adopters within the medical community will start to do that. The fears of, oh, I'll be inundated with email and I won't be able to survive will go away, and they'll start to do it. I think it will start to happen. People have to build the solutions to enable that to happen.
Do you agree, Tara? You don't have to.
No, I know. I do.
Is it a day where we carry around our own medical records on our palm device or our device or our little USB flash drive, and just you go into secretary or the receptionist, excuse me, and push your flash drive in and go, here's all the information you want, and leave me alone?
Actually, I think people are doing that today. I think that people are carrying around their allergies and lab results, and they are taking on a more proactive role. But imagine if you were, riding home on the train and you were making your appointments, you were reviewing results, you were refilling prescriptions, you were getting online to get more information about a condition you have or a new medication you're taking. These are things that are all happening today with our technology. And I think it just we need to kick it up a notch, certainly. But I think also, as individuals, we need to be guiding physicians and people that are treating us to do the same.
Right.
Can I go back to something that Jason said and something that Christine said that I think the audience really needs to consider? And that is, the society needs to have a debate about two things. One, which Jason was referring to, and that is, what are our goals and objectives around public health, and how much data should be available in an aggregate sense so that we can have better outcomes orientation? Right now, we have really crappy evidence-based medicine because we don't have enough outcomes data available. And without a national patient identifier, it'll be very difficult for us to have effective longitudinal outcomes information. We as a country are going to be behind those other countries like the UK, like Korea, like Singapore, and other parts where they have a national patient identifier, ways to get aggregate information to study outcomes, particularly when it comes to personalized medicine. And the issue that you were talking about, which is also should be a social issue, which is, how should I think about risk and insurance? And while I readily accept that we ought to protect those that get the bad gene from adverse consequences, what do we do about people that have risky behavior and put their costs on society?
Right.
You can't drive a car, at least in my state, without having risk insurance. It's just a requirement. But we don't do the same thing when it comes to health insurance, and people are burdening the system, whether it's through the employer or through Medicare and Medicaid. They're burdening the system, and how are we going to think about that as a society? These are things that we don't talk about, that we need to talk about, if we really want to get a control over this $1.8 trillion in double-digit cost increases.
That's a great point. Great point.
I've got one thing to add to that, too. Another discussion that needs to be had is really a frank discussion around privacy and the technological ability to really control anonymity. So there's been some really fantastic research done the past couple of years by some folks. When you participate, for example, in a clinical trial, there's de-identified data. But it turns out that if you take publicly available databases like voter registration databases, and maybe pay $25 to get some other database from the courthouse, and you take the de-identified clinical data, like Julia Sweeney was a researcher at Carnegie Mellon, she identified the medical records of the governor. And this was, he participated in this clinical trial with the confidence that it was de-identified data. And so there's a value proposition here that's lurking that I think that it's going to start, I'll make another reference since we're in the Computer History Club, with something very similar to the home computer club or the homebrew computer club, where there are people who become what Isaac Kohane has called health information altruists, who understand the risks that in order to get the value of your health information over the long term and contribute to the advancement of science and medicine, there is going to be some risk involved in participating in clinical trials and you know, in all sorts of clinical studies. But at the end of the day, the value that maybe you individually or your family or the future of, you know, humanity gets from participating in this type of research is so great that you can risk sharing some of your information to this. And this is a critical question because I think ultimately there's going to be a need for patients to be able to completely control the disclosure information and decide that I want my information to be shared with scientists and physicians who are doing research on a disease that runs in my family. It's going to do nothing but help me and help other people that are in the same situation, and that and be able to at any time get a list of people who it's been disclosed to, you know. And so there's a whole system that needs to be set up around that, but it has to be done in a very frank way that, you know, privacy is an ultimate. And that, you know, on the flip side, protecting the patients, you need to protect the researchers who are doing it. There are laptops that get run off or get lost, like at the VA every other week.
And identity thefted, you know, pretexted.
Yeah.
Let me paraphrase a question here, which has to do with, you know, when is this, you know, moving information out to the consumer too much, right? Whether I get my my genes, a certain number of my gene sequence, and think I'm at higher risk for colorectal cancer, or, you know, there's a new expression that's been bouncing around called cyberchondriacs, right? People who, you know, look up medical conditions. You know, my neck hurts. Oh my God, I've got cancer.
They bring it into their doctors.
And they bring it into the doctors, who then just say, you throw them out, right? Or go, don't bring me this stuff. You know, let me tap you on the knee with a rubber hammer, and I'll tell you if you're sick or not. You know, what about the doctor pushback? You know, is there a new teaching that needs to go on in medical schools? Is there a whole, not only a discussion in society, but does the whole medical profession have to be turned around over the next, you know, 10 or 20 years based on this flood of information because of digital means? Anyone take it?
I think that adjustment's already underway.
Starting, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. When we were introducing our physicians to the concept of email as a ubiquitous feature that was going to be available, and we just implemented that for 3.5 million members here in Northern California, of about 5,000-6,000 physicians. And not all of them just came out of medical school, so you've got some cross-generational things. And people were worried about the volume and worried about this issue too. But you talk to any physician, frankly, they'd say, well, we've already been dealing with that for years now, of people coming in with the articles, coming in with the newspaper clippings. You know, it's part of the profession now, that you have to kind of manage that dialogue with your patients when they're self-researching things that they come in with. So that's just, I think that's the culture has already changed in that way. The other thing that I think they've been learning, and it's a comment that Peter referenced, is, you know, there's initially a big concern about a flood of email, until the point when they realize, no, this is my panel. I'm managing this set of patients. Now I have this really easy way of going back and forth with them. And I think the learning curve is actually pretty attenuated between the moment of anxiety and the time when they get easy with the notion that this is just part of practice now. More so, I think, than we expected.
Yeah. Jason?
So, yeah, there's, you know, the history of medicine is chock full of lots of really, really interesting case studies where once the technological barriers to innovation were brought down, there were still significant social barriers. And one of my favorite recent examples of this is with the home pregnancy test. And, you know, ultimately, you know, earlier in the 20th century, it was required that you had to go to the doctor to get a pregnancy test because you actually had to take a woman's urine and inject a rabbit, which wasn't something you could put a product on a shelf for. And once that, you know, in the late 70s, it became possible to actually put this on a stick and package it. And so the technological barriers are brought down, but there's still social barriers. And there was a great Consumer Reports article in 1978 on the first home pregnancy test where they basically said, you know, no woman we do not recommend the home pregnancy test because only immoral women who have a problem going to the public health agency to get a pregnancy test you know, would want this, and we don't condone that. So clearly, we should not condone home pregnancy tests because it's an immoral thing. And so there are all sorts of funny issues that come up around new technology. Once it, you know, technology becomes a commodity, there's still people who would tell you that patients, if you tell them anything on their own, they're going to jump off a bridge, they're going to make mistakes. I mean, and they're going to get misinformation, which is true. I mean, it's a tough world out there, and there's the thing called the internet, which you can be told anything that you want to, anything you want to hear is out there. So you need to be smart, but that's not good enough for many people. And it's just interesting, the case studies that happen out there in the history of medicine, it's just full of these types of examples. Yeah.
Couple of questions that are sort of the same question is you know, given that a lot of payers face churn, therefore, you know, they aren't concerned about wellness over the long term. They're really just only concerned for the next year. And then another question that just says two words on it, socialized medicine, ? Mm. How do you balance those two in this digital world? I mean, which do you think would be better for rolling out a much more digitized healthcare system, one where there's a single payer and then all this administrative stuff goes away, conceptually, or one that is, as you just complained about, it's fragmented. I mean, which is going to be better for this new digital health future? Anyone want to take it?
Well,
Peter.
Again, there's an assumption underlying the question that somebody else has to pay for it. And,
right.
And I'm a believer, but for the bad gene case that I think society ought to pay for, I think at the end of the day, the consumer ends up paying for it one way or the other. And that we would have a more efficient system and a more effective system and a more empowered system if the consumer were sort of driving that economic exchange. I think if you looked at socialized medicine experiments that exist in the world, whether it be Canada or whether it be the United Kingdom and some other aspects of Europe, they have certain good characteristics associated with their dollars per head in terms of population spend, but very bad characteristics with regard to access in the way that we might think about access and why people come here. And their system, while the UK has a national health system and Connecting for Health program, which is trying to put in one infrastructure, it remains a very fragmented system with almost as much, if not more, fragmentation as we have here in the United States. So I don't believe that's an answer.
Christine, you know, Kaiser's not... It's a somewhat more closed system anyway than traditional. What are your thoughts on that topic of a single payer, you know, not on a community level, but on a national level?
This is a, I think we keep waiting for the next wave of public debate about that, because the cost curve associated with healthcare, which, by the way, is a combination of people getting older and great new technology. I mean, I go back to Peter's initial comment. We're actually, healthcare is very good at integrating technology, drugs, devices. And that's part of what drives the cost, because there's good stuff you can do for people that you couldn't do before.
Yeah, and they live longer.
And they live longer, and it costs money to do it. But it's driving us to a two-tier society,
right?
Because there's the churn that you were talking about, which is characteristic of many businesses that often don't offer coverage at all. And then you've got the, I'd say, you know, a substantial number of very responsible employers who do think longitudinally, who do think about prevention. So you've got, I think you're really moving into a two-tier world. So I think technology has the promise to help think about how to bend that cost curve. I think we're just at the beginning of understanding how, though. I think we're starting to think in our organization about e-visits, right? How much can you do with that? A lot of visits, and it's not just the doctor's time, it's the nurse's time, and it's the parking lot, and it's the everything that goes with it, is often for just a simple exchange of information, okay? And, you know, taking a half a day off work to exchange a few words about how that last medication worked, not necessarily the best use of anybody's time. And so I think we're just at the beginning of understanding what the opportunities are. It isn't the answer to the larger financing question, but it is something that I think we have to take very seriously, because the overall cost of healthcare is pretty unmanageable globally.
And growing.
Speaking globally, yes. And growing, to society.
All right, we've covered policy and economics and regulatory stuff. How about, Terry, let me start with you. What's the coolest thing you've seen recently in digital health? What you know, some application on a palm or something you've seen? What is the coolest thing that you say, my goodness, this is going to change everything?
The most interesting, coolest thing I have seen very recently is a product from a company called Telzuit that is a patient monitoring device that is put on someone's chest as they leave the hospital after they've had some kind of an incident, and it enables the patient to leave the hospital more quickly and to have monitoring at home. And I think that when you sit back and say, they're no longer under the roof of a hospital, they're not getting a visiting nurse because they don't need one, the critical information is being captured and sent via Trio.
So it has sensors for various...
It's a sensor that you wear on your chest. It's a really interesting idea, and it enables you to certainly get the patient home where they're going to feel better quickly and to continue to capture the information that you need to give them, you know, the health care they need. So I think it's an interesting application.
Good. Jason?
I think some of the most exciting things that are happening in healthcare right now are absolutely patient community driven, and there's lots of really interesting behind the scenes things happening in disease communities with patients patients who are actively taking control, particularly those with chronic conditions, and they're actually doing essentially medical discovery. And, you know, if you have a bunch of patients who are taking a pharmaceutical drug and they're reporting that they're getting an adverse side effect, if you're one patient, then it's anecdotal evidence, and the doctor looks at the package insert, and that it's not listed, so it must be something else going on in the patient's life. But if you have a whole bunch of patients who are all in the same community and they are all suffering from this, they're actually contributing to medical research.
By aggregating that information.
And so the anecdotal all of a sudden becomes aggregate knowledge.
Yeah.
And so I think we're going to see a whole lot more of patients taking control of this information and actually and taking an act. As soon as they can be convinced that there's value here for them, that it's going to happen fast and furious. So.
Christine, you must get pitched by the hour for the latest, coolest, neatest, this is going to change everything.
Yeah, and I'm going to give you an answer you don't expect at all. So the coolest thing for me is I got some data recently about people who are taking our online behavior change programs. So, you know, you might take an HRA that tells you you're stressed. You could know that. Or you need to lose some weight. You might know that too. And we have some online programs that our physicians had vetted, and we, you know, put them up thinking experimentation, we're going to try this. And the number of people who have taken these and the number of people who've moved their BMI scores, so lost significant weight over time, just through this sort of online tool that helps you identify what behaviors are helping you, what behaviors are not helping you, and then a good deal of follow-up outbound email that the member receives. I mean, I was a sponsor of this, but I was a little skeptical about how much actual behavior change something like that might reap. And it's been very, very significant. And I think what's so interesting about that is that some people need a social community, right? And some people just kind of need this sort of tool. Right. Some people need the coaching from the physician, him or herself. So I think it's some of the great stuff there is the different ways in which people change the way they think about their own health and the tools we're discovering that help them and the range of tools that we can start to provide. I think that's very exciting.
Yeah. So, Peter, I'm going to ask you slightly differently because then you'll change the question. I spent a lot of time following cardiologists around, and there's one hospital on the East Coast where, you know, they were proudly showing off their electronic medical record thing, and there was a nice Dell machine with Windows, and they would type in their password, and up on the screen would come this patient's data, and all the specs were right there, and wow, that's pretty cool. This place is wired. And then the doctor would leave the patient's room and go out, and in the middle of the nurse's station, he would pull out a notebook and open up the divider to the page that was at the patient, take a pen out, and then scribble stuff on this piece of paper. And it just occurred to me that Microsoft has so many of those tools in-house that all, you know, so many of the piece parts or the ability to acquire, you guys just bought a something recently, to acquire what you need. What do you see? What do you think can be the environment of the future for these doctors? Either what have you seen now that's cool, or what do you envision in the near term of piece parts to bring this closer to fruition?
Well, in the near term, the most exciting thing I saw, I bought, and we'll commercialize it.
So just explain what that is. Explain.
So we bought a product, a technology built by doctors for doctors in the Washington Hospital Center in Washington, D.C., that's called Azixi, which is an information architecture for getting and storing all the information known in the hospital about a patient and providing a clinical view for the clinician to be able to see that patient, all of his visits in that hospital or any other hospital connected to this system, and any other patient that might be theirs. And so it's a health intelligence engine, and we hope to bring that kind of flexibility and response times and information that we're used to doing in the business world
right.
to the clinical world. Our view of what that might look for, like, you know, 5 years from now, there's so many of, as you say, our building block technologies that would dramatically improve the patient safety and the enterprise effectiveness and the doctor's job in the hospital by doing simple things like presence. I assume everybody in this room uses IM of one form or another. And if I'm a doctor doing a consult, I need somebody else. If I know which one is interruptible
right.
and can share my state with them just like I can in IM today, that would be incredibly valuable. Would lead to better patient safety, better patient outcomes, faster response times, and better productivity. So there's a whole host of things, as you said, that if we can integrate them into this environment, we'll be able to deliver a lower cost, higher quality, more robust, easier to deploy solution. We hope to do that.
So what our kids can do playing games today, eventually our doctors will have in their hands as well.
Not eventually, soon.
Soon. Last question, please, which the chart says. If you had the ear of a senator, of United States Senate, which you probably all do, and the question arose, okay, I'm about to write a piece of legislation and to change the healthcare system for the better and incorporate digital health, what would your suggestion be to Senator Blutarsky? Yes.
I think a really easy one, which isn't, it's about physician state licensure. So, you know, I think there's a significant opportunity with web technologies and all sorts of technologies, and there's expertise spread all over the world. And just because you live in San Francisco or Palo Alto doesn't mean that the world's expert is in this city or in this state even. They may be at, you know, on the East Coast, and you don't necessarily should need to fly there for them to actually service you.
Right.
Current legislation existing policies where, you know, physicians have to get licensed individually in states. And so there's a constraint around patients without actually physically being there in the presence of the, you know, physician of actually getting services from them. And that's just old. Shouldn't be that way. So that's an easy one, I think, for okay. that would promote digital health. And
so a nationwide bar?
Sure. You could even make it where whoever has the most stringent, and there'd be an argument about that, or the most difficult, or, state licensure. And if you achieve that, then you could, as a doctor, practice in any state you wanted to. So okay. you could do, you know, remote meeting of patients.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. Tara, you got a thought?
Not yet.
Okay, that's all right. You have about 30 seconds. Peter.
I've thought long and hard about this, and I don't think there is a silver bullet that Congress can help solve the problem. I think they can create a lot of challenges. The one thing that I think, if you really wanted to do the best for society over the long run, I'd start us down the path to get rid of employer-paid health care.
Just...
employer-paid health care fundamentally creates a set of disincentives that
right.
work against our interests.
So make it tax neutral via health savings accounts or some super health savings account or just...
The simplest thing to do is you could freeze at a point in time and just convert the benefit into dollars for the consumer to spend and deal with the hard problem that we talked about is how do you deal with a bad gene consequence?
Right.
Right? Because that's the thing that you need this aggregated pool to fix.
Christine?
I think I would go to Jason's comment maybe a little bit more globally, and that's resisting the temptation to pass legislation that inhibits innovation. And it's easy to do. Mm-hmm. It's easy to do because we get a lot of legislation that creates extra investment requirements that we have to make, and that's resources away.
So that means changing the FDA approval process, for example, or...
Oh, well, I'll give you the example that we recently had some Medicare legislation that required enormous IT investments in order to conform to the new approach. It was not terribly material to the end beneficiary.
Right.
It was just very costly. The money there
for compliance with the new
regulations. The money there is money that isn't going into other kinds of innovation. So that kind of thing. It's just like what you're saying about licensure, but a more kind of a global point about fostering.
Okay. And why don't I end it? I happen to think that we have a few too many, actually, venture capitalists sitting on Sand Hill Road and elsewhere that will fund a lot of the innovations for digital health, whether it be medical devices or software or systems and the like. And, you ask the venture capitalist what his dream policy idea is, and it's always the same answer, which is cut capital gains taxes. And it magically works. They invest more. So with that, I want to thank everyone for being here and thank the panel for all the wonderful discussion and for all the questions, and thank you very much.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program. Again, we'd like to thank our panel members, Tara Griffin, Peter Neupert, Christine Page, Jason Bobe, and moderator Andy Kessler. Special thanks to our presenting sponsor, Microsoft Corporation, and to all of you for joining us. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, is adjourned.